Okay, yeah, so we'll continue with the worldly wind. So this is evening number two of four evenings on the worldly winds. Before I go any further, I should perhaps just mention as well, we have Vajragupta's book on the shrine, Sailing the Worldly Winds, where he discusses these topics, obviously. And no doubt they're for sale in the bookshop, I would imagine. Yes, of course they are. So there we are. So yeah, last week we introduced the worldly winds. So just to recap, here they are on the flip chart. So we have four pairs. We have, on one side, we have what might be considered desirable. And on the other hand, on the other side, we have what might be considered undesirable. So we have gain and loss, praise and criticism, which you may hear referred to as praise and blame, fame and infamy, which I'm using the terms respect and disgrace, and pleasure and pain. So this evening, I'd like to go into the first two of those pairs in more detail. So gain and loss and praise and criticism. And it was quite interesting in the group, the discussion group I was in last week, the two items that brought up the strongest emotional memories tended to be loss and criticism. So yeah, we'll look at those a bit more this evening. So first gain and loss then. So gain and loss really is about the things that we surround ourselves with. So we tend to surround ourselves with a cloud of things of various types that we regard as ours, our property, belonging to us. It's almost like we add them into ourselves. We almost extend ourselves with these things, this collection of things. And there's all types of things. The most obvious type is the tangible things, the physical things that we tend to think of first, perhaps, when we talk about gain and loss. So things like watches or mobile phones or shoes or houses or cars. So these sorts of things you can touch and feel. Very much things that, you know, there's a sense of proprietary, no, I can't say that word, ownership of. So things that we feel that we own. But there's other things too. So there's some things that are intrinsic to us that we feel are ours, such as our body, for example, our minds, our personality. So these things aren't really going to be stolen from us, perhaps, except perhaps in a science fiction movie. But generally speaking, those things we hang on to, nobody's going to give us a new personality. So, but there are losses in that area, bodily losses, for example. We can lose our faculties through illness or aging or accident. So things can happen and we can lose things in that way. And people of my age, for example, start to realise that for themselves. Then there are people, the people that we think of as ours. So various different types of relationships. Some of the relationships are relatively unchanging, lifelong. So things like my children, my grandchildren, my parents, my preceptor, they don't really change as a rule. Other things, other people, you might say, come and go through our lives. So we have our friends, our partners, our work colleagues or bosses. So these people might come and go from our lives as the circumstances change. And of course, in this area, there are some very big gains and losses to be held in terms of people. So gaining, have new arrivals, new children or grandchildren, new relationships starting, all very exciting. But on the other hand, then you can lose things. You know, relationships can end. Of course, the people close to you can die. So there's some big wins and losses here, you might say. And ultimately, of course, from our own perspective, our own death, our own loss of life. Then there are what you might call imaginary things, which are actually quite important to us. I've read Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, And in this book, he talks about the thing that has given humans such power, really. And he says it's not really intelligence or our tool-making ability or the articulation of our hands. It's our ability to collectively believe in concepts, these imaginary things that we kind of make real in our own minds, but really speaking don't exist. So he gave an example of a big company. I think it was Renault, the motor car company that he gave the example of. So if you think of Renault or any other big company, they've got employees, they've got offices, they've got stock, they've got a balance sheet, they've got shareholders, and so on. But companies go out of business, don't they? I mean, like, where's Woolworths now, for example? So overnight, a company like Renault could go out of business. Not that I'm saying Renault is going to go out of business if you've got shares in them. I'm just using them as an example. So overnight, they could go out of business, and then the employees are no longer Renault employees. The buildings don't belong to Renault anymore. There are no shareholders anymore. Everything that belonged to Renault no longer exists because Renault no longer exists. And it doesn't exist because collectively we choose no longer to believe in it. And it's the same with countries. So the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, does it? Or East Germany. And yet these things are imaginary. They only exist in the imagination of human beings. If there were no human beings, none of these things would exist. There'd be no countries, no companies, and so on. And yet we believe in them so much, we feel so attached to them, we buy into them to such an extent, we would even be prepared, perhaps, to fight for these things, to fight for our country, for example, even to die for these things. And all the time, really speaking, they're only imaginary. Now, I'm not saying that we should abandon the idea of these concepts because they are actually very useful. But it is interesting that they are of this nature and we should just sort of bear in mind their true nature. So there's these things that we tend to think of as ours as well, my country and my company that I work for and so on. Other things tend to pass through our hands. So we own them for a period of time, like a family heirloom, a piece of jewellery that might be passed down from one generation to the next, and you might pass it on to the next generation. Or a second-hand shirt that I might buy at a charity shop, I wear for a bit, and when I finish with it, I'll return it to the charity shop or recycle it or something like that. And all these things then, you know, they belong to somebody else, they belong to me, and then they belong to somebody else. The same is true with money. The coins in my pocket that I've got here, they're in my pocket now, but a few days ago they would have been in somebody else's pocket, and in a few days' time they'll be again in another person's pocket. So in that case, are they really mine, really speaking? If they pass from one person to another in this way, are they really ours, or are really we just custodians of these things, temporary custodians, looking after them for a while? And then if you think of the billions of people that no longer live, that have lived on this planet and have died, they may have spent a great deal of their lives trying to acquire all these things. And now, collectively, these billions of people, between them, own precisely nothing, because that's what happens, isn't it? I remember a film I was watching, a comedy film with Danny DeVito, and he was talking about his understanding of the purpose of life. And he basically said that the purpose of life is whoever owns much money, the most money, when they die, wins. And it just shows kind of how absurd that that whole thing is, really. And yet, of course, we do put a lot of our time and a lot of effort into acquiring those things. And then other things that we think of as ours, strictly speaking, aren't ours at all. I'm thinking of things like my son, for example. Now, it's a convenient way of talking about an individual, saying my son, my partner, my children, that sort of thing. But of course, we don't own them. And yet, we do, at times, perhaps, behave as if we do own them. We try to influence them, perhaps even control them in some ways. My mum is 85 now, And she still tells the story of when she was a teenager and decided she wanted to be a nurse. And she came home and told her mum, "I'd like to be a nurse." And her mum said, "Oh no, you don't, my girl. I don't want you coming home here at all hours of the night. You're gonna have to get an office job." So she became a shorthand typist. But here we are, nearly 70 years later, and she still remembers that and feels sad about it and regrets it. She does say, "If I came back, I would like to be a nurse." And that's really quite sad, isn't it? That people try to control other people's lives in that way. But I guess we tend to do that to an extent. And then, of course, there's cats. And cats are slightly different, the exception that proves the rule. I cringe a bit when people say, inwardly, when people say things like, "I own a cat." Because I don't really think you own a cat. I think the cat maybe thinks it owns you, perhaps. You might have heard the thing Winston Churchill said, which was he liked pigs. And he used to say that a dog looks up to you, a cat looks down on you, but a pig treats you as an equal. And I think that's a certain amount of truth in that, really. But anyway, cats, I don't think, do think of themselves as being owned. They share a house with us when they choose to. But true to their nature and their high spiritual attainment, they're showing us the way and how to give up attachment and how to be loosely attached to things. And so if a cat gets a better offer, if it doesn't like where it lives, then it will vote with its paws, won't it, and move house, as they sometimes do. We do even extend our idea of possession, or what we think we should be in possession of, to people, to other people's possession. And I'm thinking here particularly of people who are maybe close to death or have died. The idea of inheritance and wills can be an area for a great deal of conflict. I've heard of a couple of stories myself where families fall out for decades and don't talk to one another because of a conflict over a will. It crops up in newspapers quite often. People challenge wills. I watched a film over the weekend, Foxcatcher, about John DuPont, a member of the DuPont family in the United States, very wealthy family. They own the DuPont business. And he was very wealthy. And when he died, he left $200 million. And he gave 80% of it to a Bulgarian wrestler. And the other 20% he gave to a foundation for the preservation of Pacific birds. And some members of his family were, perhaps not surprisingly, a little unhappy about this and challenged this will. But they didn't succeed, and so the Bulgarian wrestler got $160 million, presumably. But you kind of understand how you can feel that way. I suppose particularly if you were caring for somebody for a period of time, and they died, and in the will they gave all their money to a Bulgarian wrestler, you might feel a little unhappy. But I think it's an example where our emotions can lead us astray here, really. Because we don't have any right to other people's property. It's up, if they're alive, you know, if I want to give my money to a Bulgarian wrestler, then it's up to me, isn't it? It might be a foolish thing to do, but I can. So, you know, why would it be different in a will? And yet we can think, perhaps, that we have this rights over somebody's property once they've died. And it does cause a lot of conflict. So as I say, our emotions can perhaps lead us astray here and lead us away from what's ethical and what's best and what's really in our own interests. So, having said all that, let's say we're going to work. It's the morning, and we come into some money. We come into £1,000 somehow or other. Maybe we do one of those scratch card things, and or something like that, and we get £1,000. So that would be quite nice, wouldn't it? And speaking for myself, I would probably start to think about the things that I might do with that £1,000. You know, go for a nice meal, or give somebody a present, or small holiday or something, that would be quite nice. And that's fair enough, isn't it? And then let's say we go home and we find that our boiler has broken. And wouldn't you know, it's going to cost £1,000 to get it fixed up. How does that feel? not quite so good, does it? It feels like that money's been taken away. It's not very pleasant. But these kinds of gains and losses occur all the time. Not maybe £1,000, sometimes more than £1,000, but often smaller items of that nature. And we're blown about by those worldly winds all the time, really. So one approach the Buddha had, and his followers who gave up the household life, was to have a minimum of possessions, a minimum of things. So they only had, really the things that they absolutely needed. So their clothes, their begging bowl, and I think they had a water strainer and a razor, and just a handful of things, really. And they even gave up their families and their tribe, so that they believed that they didn't belong to any family or tribe. So they really tried to give up all their attachments that they could. I saw you might think I watch a lot of TV from this talk, actually, but I saw on another TV show, there was this a community in New York State, and a community of men that lived in a house. They were Christians, and they tried to live quite a frugal life. So one thing they did was, periodically, every 2 or 3 months or so, they'd get together and they'd all go round the house in a group and try to find the things. They'd look through all their belongings, personal and collective, and find the things that they didn't think they needed. And so they'd be there. They were looking at the kitchen utensils, and they were saying, hey, gee, we've got two colanders here. Do we need two colanders? It's a bit excessive, isn't it? So they take all the things they didn't need to the charity shop. So that's what they would do on a regular basis. So I've got a little question now. What I'm going to suggest is we get into small groups of maybe threes. Probably threes is best. And the question I have for you is, do you have any items that you hang on to that perhaps you might feel you could give away? Maybe you could declutter. Like, do you have a collection of calendars, for example? So if you'd like to get into groups of about three, we'll have just about 5 minutes, and see if there's any items that you can come up with that you might be able to take to the charity shop. If I'd lost it, if this wasn't there anymore, how would that feel? Okay, well, thank you. We better move on. It would probably be quite difficult for us to be like the Buddha and many of his followers who took up the homeless life. It would not be quite so easy to do that here, and maybe not so desirable as well. Which means that we will be subject to gains and losses. Well, in fact, even the Buddha was subject to gains and losses. He was given pieces of land and so on for his to congregate on, and he lost various of his friends and colleagues. So we can never get away from it completely. But within the world that we live, even if we declutter and try to avoid reclutter, then we will still be subject to gains and losses. And from my own experience, I find that I can make it much worse by telling myself stories about it. So I'm thinking particularly of the problem I have with my hip. I broke my hip running in the London Marathon in 1994, and it got fixed up until about 2000, when it started to play up again, which meant that I had difficulty walking for more than a few minutes. And when that that situation occurred on a couple of times, and on both times that it occurred, it took me a few weeks to come to terms with it, really, because I was telling myself these stories like, why would it happen? Why should it happen to me? And it means I can't do this and I can't do that. So I'd go through all the things that I couldn't do, all the plans that I had that would now fall through. What if it got worse? So on and so forth. And it took a couple of weeks for these things to kind of settle down. And I kind of withdrew from things during that period. And so, the first couple of times that happened, I noticed that effect. So that's not very helpful. So in the case that we do get home and we find that our boiler's broken and we have to shell out £1,000, and so we're £1,000 down. We've lost £1,000. We could tell ourselves stories, but that probably doesn't help. Such as, you know, well, why does it always happen to me? Oh, things are always breaking. Just the other week that broke. Or we could think about the things now that we're not going to be able to afford. I was going to do this and now I can't. And I was going to buy that and now I can't. And we could blame, which was kind of one of the primary things that came up in our discussion group last week. In the case of loss, it was often blaming ourselves, interestingly enough. How could I be so stupid? In the case of the boiler, it might be blaming, I don't know, an engineer or something for not fixing it properly or what have you. But I still, thinking of blaming oneself, when I was about 20, so a long time ago now, and when I went on a bus, we did have buses back in those days, and I didn't have much money at all. I was unemployed, but I was on a government scheme, a training scheme. When I went on the bus to go to work, or go to the training scheme, I had a £20 note, but I didn't have any change. And neither did the bus driver. And so he said, I'll get the change off me when you get off the bus. And I forgot. Mm-hmm. And so I'd lost about 17 or 18 quid then. And I still remember it now. And it was a lot of money then, for me in those circumstances. But it's odd, isn't it, how it kind of stays with you. You know, it's relatively insignificant. I could let it go, surely, but it's still there. I nearly brought it up in the discussion group last week, but I managed to stop myself. So there's all those things that we can't do. And yeah, we can kind of identify that, hopefully, and work with that. Notice when those things are happening, telling ourselves stories, blaming people, blaming ourselves, and help to work with that. But I've got another question for you now. So if you'd like to get back into your groups, or different groups if you like, you can mix it up a bit if you want. The question is, how can we respond skillfully to gains? And I suppose from that we could get to how might we behave unskillfully. So how might we behave skillfully to a gain? Okay, again about 5 minutes. Right, so let's move on. I did say last week that I would I had antidotes and false antidotes. Now they are just for fun, and it's just suggestions. It's not the word of the Buddha or anything. So I'm just suggesting that they might be something to have in mind. So for a false antidote, it seemed to me that the idea of quite hard asceticism is probably, or may not be, helpful. The Buddha always tried to have the approach of the middle way between hard asceticism and indulgence. And with hard asceticism, if you went to live in a cave or something like that and avoided all these sorts of things that might tempt you to gains and losses, maybe that would work. But maybe all you're doing is actually avoiding it rather than dealing with the issue, because the issue isn't the things themselves. It's our attachment to them, and that's really what we need to work on. So my suggested antidote is generosity. So I think that can work to break down the barrier between ourselves and others, and also lessen the attachment of the things that we have around us, so the things that we perceive to be ours. So let's move on to praise and criticism now. I'm going to start with critical feedback. And critical feedback is, as we discovered in our discussion group last week, challenging, and it does cause emotions to arise, perhaps reactions sometimes. And, to be honest, I find it difficult myself sometimes, even in, you know, a nice, safe environment like the Sangha, it's quite difficult. Maybe not difficult is the right word, but it can be challenging to receive critical feedback, even though that I know Or I believe that the people who are giving me critical feedback are doing it with the best of intentions and telling what they see to be the truth. I realize that not everybody is going to like a thing that I do. No one is going to like everything I do. And even geniuses don't do great things 100% of the time. I'm sure Shakespeare knocked out the odd dodgy sonnet from time to time. I know Rammstein, you know, some of their, just the one or two tracks aren't quite as good as the others. So these things do happen. So, but we do try to give feedback within the Sangha. Sometimes we might do it a bit clumsily, I suppose, if we're honest. And sometimes it might be received a bit clumsily as well. And personally, I would also say, I find it quite difficult to give critical feedback. That's something that I feel I have felt for some time. I need to work on. It's not something that I find very easy. And I suppose there are reasons for that. Well, obviously there are reasons for that. Some reasons might be that I'm concerned that the person I'm giving feedback to, might feel bad, might get upset. But is that the real reason? Or is it really because I'd feel bad because they feel bad? Am I really just concerned about how I feel? And then I suppose I'm concerned that I might be wrong. I may not have confidence in my views. And I might think, well, I could get it wrong. And also some people can react quite strongly to critical feedback as well. And that's not very good. And in many ways, it's easier just to keep your head down, isn't it? To not put your head above the parapet. Have an easy life. But none of those reasons are good enough. It's really important to give critical feedback, even though it's quite a difficult thing to do. It's very important within the context of the Sangha. It's difficult to have an objective view of ourselves. So it's really important to get feedback from people who you trust, who can tell you what their views are. So feedback, very, very important. And do you ever watch those things like X Factor or Britain's Got Talent, things like that? No. Well, I'll tell you about them from what people have told me. And, from what I understand, in the early stages of the competition, they often have, as a bit of a joke, people who are terrible, basically. But the trouble is, these people don't realise they're terrible. And it's quite sad because some of them genuinely have this dream of being, you know, the next Mariah Carey or the next Madonna or the next Prince or something like that. And then they go on national TV in front of millions of people, in front of their families and friends, and are humiliated, basically, because they're genuinely terrible. And that's entertainment, apparently. And wouldn't it be good, though, if somebody, you know, a friend or a member of the family, just sort of said to them beforehand that, you know, I know you like singing, but I don't think you're quite at that standard where, you know, you're going to be the next Madonna or what have you, rather than having that public humiliation.
Yes.
Yeah, good point. Maybe they did. Yeah. Or maybe they thought it was worthwhile for the fame. I don't know. But there we are. So it's good to give feedback sometimes. And I undertake to endeavour to welcome feedback from other people. And I also undertake to endeavour to give critical feedback generally when it's appropriate to do so. So, I have another little question for you now in your groups, which is, how should we handle critical feedback? There we go. Got about 5 minutes. How should we receive it if we're the subject of critical feedback? Okay, good. Well, we better move on once more. So that was critical feedback. So let's look at praise now. Of course, it's nice to receive praise, isn't it? Isn't it? No, not necessarily, no. If you've ever been the beneficiary of rejoicing in merits, it is pleasant, it's nice, but also excruciating at the same time, isn't it? It's a funny thing, really, isn't it? What's also funny is some people, you cannot give them a compliment. You cannot praise them at all without them negating it and trying to diffuse it, like you've given them a hand grenade and they have to diffuse it. It's really funny. Try doing that to some, perhaps outside the Sangha, just sort of try giving them a compliment. And they, you know, people say things like, oh, there was nothing really, or Jawala Malini did most of the work, or I didn't think that middle bit was very good, or whatever it might be. Almost impossible. It's quite funny. I don't know whether a part of that is a British thing, because I think in Britain we have a bit of a thing about big head. Is that, I feel like I'm in a school playground. Do grown-ups say big head? I don't know. But you know what I mean, don't you? You know, it's a term that of abuse you learn very young, don't you? A big head. He's a big head. And we've got a bit of a, I think we've got a bit of a thing about big heads. It doesn't make sense anyway, do you? You don't get a big head. If there are any people who aren't British here, maybe they could throw some light on it as well. But I think we do have a thing about people getting big head. Big-headed, yes, in this country. And it's something they're a bit concerned about. And we can also feel that through insecurity, we can feel that, people don't really mean it. You know, they had to say that, didn't they? And in fact, you know, they had to say that. In fact, I think less of them now because they're obviously a poor judge. So, but we need to let go of that, don't we? That sort of insecurity. It seems very deeply ingrained as well. But a lot of these things, you know, come up as emotional responses. But I think we just have to sort of look at them and think, yeah, I know that's just an emotional response that comes up. But I can just let that go. I don't have to let that drive me. I once did some training, actually, on receiving compliments, on how to accept a compliment. It was on an assertiveness course that I went on. And a part of it was how to receive compliments. And they were talking about this very stuff. And they said, quite simple, really. To receive a compliment, all you need to do is just say, thank you. So I mean, but generally it's quite nice to get praise, even if it's tinged with other things as well. And I guess there is that risk that we could become a bit inflated, a bit puffed up. So my final question for your groups this evening is it okay to feel good about something you've done? Is it okay to feel good about something a family member's done? Is it okay to feel good about something your country's done? Okay, so we'll have maybe about 7 minutes this time. So yourself, family member, country. Yeah, when I was thinking about it, and I think, I agree. I think there's a number of levels that you can respond, a gradation perhaps. And I thought, that, yeah, maybe if you've done a good job, then maybe somebody praises you, then feeling pleased about that, it seems reasonable, I thought. But then I suppose you can go to the next level, whereas rather than feeling just pleased with what you've done, you can start to feel pleased with yourself. As you say, you know, the ego starts getting involved and you can start to appropriate that praise and that feeling that not what I've done is good, but I'm good. Start to big yourself up. And right up to, I suppose, hubris, which I looked up because I wasn't completely sure what it meant. And the dictionary told me that it means extreme pride or arrogance ultimately leading to one's downfall. So that's very Greek tragedy, isn't it? So we don't want that. So So yeah, it seems like there's a grade of responses, I suppose, and to which we could respond. And I was thinking that in terms of an antidote, I started to think about politics, because I quite like politics, quite interests me, I like talking about it. But I don't think I would ever be a politician, partly because they have to, I feel quite sorry for them sometimes, that they have to deal with such horrible criticism sometimes, really personal, unpleasant criticism, with death threats and, well, even one MP was killed, wasn't she? But let's just keep it to the criticism side. And especially with these days of social media, but the newspapers as well are so unpleasant. And I think I would find that difficult, really. I don't think I would cope with that very well. It would just be too much. And I was thinking that I would need to develop a thicker skin to be able to deal with that. So I was thinking that could be an antidote, couldn't it? But that's a false antidote, I think, because of course, if you're growing a thicker skin, you're just becoming, you're not feeling the feelings anymore. You're not hearing what people are saying, and you're just becoming isolated from any feedback that you get. So you're not going to benefit from any feedback that you get. So so I thought that was a false antidote. So then I started thinking of other things. And of course, the Buddha said that we should give people, tell people the truth when it's helpful to do so. So we shouldn't just go around telling people the truth or the truth as we see it, willy-nilly, regardless of whether they want to hear it or not. You could be seen as being very critical and judgmental if you perhaps did that. So we need to have some sensitivity, I think, and we need to be aware when people are ready to hear what we might be prepared to say to them. So I think those things are important. And perhaps above all, we should try to be as truthful and as honest is possible in both giving feedback and receiving feedback. So that would be my antidote suggestion, would be truthfulness. So if we're if when we're giving feedback we're being, or we try to be sensitive, we try to be kind, and we try to be truthful and honest, then really we're doing about as much as we can. So thank you for listening.